Bienvenido a Kaiser Permanente. El doctor ya te puede ver. Verá que aunque eres muy activo, ahora te cansas más rápido de lo normal. Verá que a menudo almuerzas comida rápida.
Próxima ventanilla.
Verá que pones a tu familia primero y tu salud tiende a caer en segundo o tercer lugar. Y claro que verá que tienes el azúcar alto, igual que tu papá. En Kaiser Permanente trabajamos juntos para ver todo lo que tú eres y darte el cuidado que tú mereces. Kaiser Permanente, para todo lo que tú eres.
Hello and welcome to the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Richard Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith, and we've got a special episode for you. Two fantastic filmmakers, Dylan Southern and Will Lovelace, would make the perfect film for us, perfect film for you as listeners, as your fans, just like us, the noughties indie scene. And they go right back to where it all started in New York back in the early 2000s. Now, you may have heard of the book Meet Me in the Bathroom by Lizzie Goodman. Well, this is the film version of that renowned, respected book, which detailed the rise of the Strokes, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Rapture, Interpol, LCD Sound System, Moldy Peaches, and many, many more bands that came out of the Big Apple back then.
Yeah, it's a fantastic behind-the-scenes look at that scene. The old-school footage, the live shows, the interviews are amazing. You know, we were really fortunate to get a look at it before it came out a few months ago, and it's just a fantastic snapshot of that very unique, special era that we all absolutely love. So, yeah, one to really, really get your teeth into. We had so many people sending us articles around the time that film was first put out in selected cinemas. There's a great article in The Guardian in particular. And now, as well as it still being shown in some UK cinemas, you can also stream it on Amazon Video, Apple TV and Microsoft. So we comes highly recommended from us.
Yeah, absolutely. Go and check it out. The subtitle for the original book was The Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York between 2001 and 2011. And I think it's fair to say this film really brings that important, influential scene to life. It really is a must watch. So, well, here are the two filmmakers who produced it telling us all about it.
Right, this week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by the Meet Me in the Bathroom directors, Dylan Southern and Will Lovelace. How are you both?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
No, it's a pleasure. It's, you know, me and Richard both had a look at the film and loved it, you know, right up our street, of course, with this podcast as well. But what drew you guys into making this film and what appealed about that era to you?
Well, we've both read Lizzie Goodman's book, which it's kind of inspired by, loosely based on, I guess. Dylan had got an early copy of it, and we both read it and loved the format, the oral history, loved the time. And in that book, there's obviously hundreds of characters, but it's like such a page turner. And we thought straight away that, you know, we could make a film based on part. Our initial thought was the first part of her book, but we can make a film based on that period, that kind of, you know, we grew up in the UK listening to that music, and it just felt like a great fit, really.
I think it was the era itself that was a big kind of draw, because, you know, we've made other music documentaries in the past. We made one about Blur. We made LCD Sound System's final, at the time, concert film. But with this one, it was a music story, but it also took place at a fascinating point in history, just as the internet was emerging. You know, not many people had mobile phones. And, you know, unbeknownst to everybody, the world was about to change in several ways, you know, technologically, culturally, politically. And it was almost like this was a little kind of moment of innocence before everything started accelerating. So, you know, not only was it a story about bands making great music, it was a story about a very specific moment in time before everything started to change.
Yeah, yeah, really incredible footage that you have managed to get in the film, you know, considering, like, say, with the lack of mobile phone cameras at that time, or the lack of quality, and then we shall we say. But obviously, digital cameras were on the uptake, but it must have taken a hell of a lot of work to, you know, pull all that footage together. Like, how did you access it? Loads of archives, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, with great difficulty in some cases. It was, it was 2 years of intensive detective work by us, but not just us. The editors, the producers. We had an archive researcher, but finding the really kind of intimate band specific stuff, you know, took yeah, as I said, detective work. We would kind of go on early message boards from the time and find people and then relocate them through their current social media handles, and or we would see a mini disc recorder in the back of a photograph and then do the detective work to find the owner of that mini disc recorder, which journalist it was that happened to be with that photographer that day, and then see if they still had that recording. So yeah, it was a really long process and very different to the types of films we've made before, where we're just on the road with the band or filming a concert, or, you know, this time we knew what story we had to tell, but we weren't going to be going out there with cameras ourselves. So we had to locate the footage that was needed to tell every bit of the story. And sometimes it just didn't exist and we had to change course. Sometimes we discovered stuff that we hadn't, you know, imagined was out there, and we'd have to adapt our approach to that. But it was a really sort of rewarding process. But it meant we went into the edit with probably 10% of what we needed. And so the edit progressed as the search for archive progressed.
Yeah, interesting doing it that way around. And as Rich said there, just great detective work from your side. But there were moments in it where they're filming themselves in moments where you just think, I can't even believe they're filming themselves at this point. There's not really much going on. They're just hanging out backstage or something like that. Whereas now you think, yeah, people just whip their phones out and film almost everything, don't they? But, you know, to get the camcorder out or whatever it was back then, it's just these little nuggets. But it just gives a fascinating insight, I thought, to the personalities of these superstars when they're, you know, they're not up on stage, but just capturing these little vulnerable moments sometimes as well.
We were those guys back then with the DV camera. Like,
I'm unfortunately not filming these bands, but
no, we were filming far less successful bands up in Liverpool. So, you know, I think part of it was we were following bands around at that time, and we were the guys with the cameras, like getting those moments that you talk about. So we figured if we were doing it, each one of these bands must have had someone, you know. There's always like a friend of the band who documents like the early days, and that was very much our sort of thought process, was like, let's find the people who are around them at that time.
Well, I think you're right about how, you know, how it feels like when you watch that footage, because I think no one's considering where the footage is going to go at that point. It's not going to go on Instagram. YouTube was like 5 years after this period, and so I think you get what it's like to be a friend of the band filming, and that's what it is. Usually it's like, you know, one of their mates or someone who's kind of in the inner circle. So it's not like having someone from a social media, you know, manager or whatever filming something that they've got to film. It's just some person with a camera, and I think that's why you get that, you know, slightly
innocent. Feels more authentic.
Yeah, exactly.
Because like now, if someone whips out their phone, immediately you're self-conscious. Where's this going to end up? Like, what do I look like? And then there's just much more of a sort of naivety or an innocence. You know, it's they're just documenting the moment, and it's there's no sense of what it's for, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So we get to see people like Julian Casablancas or Karen O, obviously becoming stars within the New York scene, but also on a trajectory which takes them to world stardom as well, doesn't it? And you can sort of see they're almost these people who are so confident on stage, but some fears and anxieties about what's going on in the bigger picture for them.
Yeah, exactly. I think we found a fanzine, actually, which was a fanzine that doesn't exist anymore. We bought a copy on eBay, and there was a photo shoot, an interview with the Strokes when they first got signed on that first tour of the UK, and it just feels like they're far more relaxed with that side of it, because they haven't had all the, you know, sensational stuff written about them at that point. They feel their guard is more down, and you can see as the film goes on, particularly Julian starting to not enjoy it, you know, starting to feel like it's a drag, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the the amazing elements of this film is that contrast. You do get to see that vulnerability of some of these stars and certainly how their feelings change over that period of time. But the contrast to that, to the confidence on stage, that intensity of their live shows, you know, and the doc, again, it's really captured amazingly the energy of those gigs. And it was just such a vibrant scene. And yeah, it must be quite exciting for you guys to sort of unearth particular footage of live shows that really did capture that.
Yeah, I mean, we've got in there, we've got one of the earliest Stroke shows. We've got the first ever Yeah, Yeah, Yeah show. We've got the first ever LCD show. And, you know, when those pieces of archive came in, sometimes we didn't know they existed. And so, we'd sort of get a lead on something. And, you know, you sort of felt very privileged to be seeing these performances that no one had looked at for, you know, 20 years in some cases. So yeah, no, really exciting. And one of the biggest problems with the film was like what to leave out, because there's so many amazing performances that didn't make it into the film, because, you know, we had to tell the stories of a whole scene over, you know, multiple bands over 90 to 100 minutes. So yeah, just some incredible, particularly bands like Liars, like every time there's a live performance by them to look at, it's just so intense and so kind of takes you back to that moment. But yeah, the one we've got in there, which is in the sort of parking lot show a year after 9/11, was just such an amazing performance that, you know, that was the one that we put in. But yeah, so much stuff left on the cutting room floor.
And you'd find like certain tours, like that first Yeah Yeahs tour to the UK, there's a performance in there, or might be a couple of performances in there, but there's so many good performances and like they had someone shooting with them and I think other people are just randomly filming at gigs. And so we find these, you know, whole sections where you've just got loads of brilliant performances, and then other times it was really hard to find the performance. Like Dylan mentioned, we've got the first LCD, their first ever show, and we had their second ever show in the edit for a while, and knowing that the first one existed, but desperately trying to find it, and that kind of came in at the last moment. So yeah, so it was super exciting seeing that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. What's interesting to me about this scene as well is the influence it had around the world, but also on the UK scene. Basically, you know, look at bands like the Libertines. I think were pretty much held up as like the UK Strokes. You know, the way they dress, the sort of music they provided, and the stories around the members of that band. So in the doc, we see, as you mentioned there, Yeah Yeahs touring the UK. I think we see the Strokes coming over as well. Really interesting, wasn't it? That sort of cross-Atlantic connection at that time, because I guess we looked to America for those inspirations initially, but I think you also saw from those bands a feeling that they wanted to as well to have a big impact in the UK. It was important to them at that time.
I think it was essential. And I think, you know, those bands all broke in New York, but it wasn't so much a scene. Like if you look at them, the Strokes and Interpol aesthetically are completely different, and they didn't really hang out, you know. And then you have like the Brooklyn art punk of Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Liars and TV on the Radio, which again is a very different kind of aesthetic and a different musical sensibility. And then you have what James was doing, like kind of combining dance music with punk, which again was completely different. And I think the notion of it being a scene, I think the British music press played such a huge part in that, because, you know, Enemy, Melody Maker was still around at the time, and all the music press loved to get behind the scene. And because of all of these things happening simultaneously in New York, I remember that famous cover, the We Love New York cover, which I think was 2000 or early 2001. You know, it felt like it was happening here, and then all the bands had to come here, you know. And I think there was this, you know, it's hard to break America, but it's easy to break England because we're an island. So I feel like that was a rite of passage. They all came, you know, the Strokes got signed in the UK before they got signed in the US. You know, all of the bands came over here and toured and you know, were nationally known in the UK before they were nationally known in America. So I think there was a real kind of, you know, an element of the UK being very, very important for this scene breaking out.
I think another sort of big elements of the film that stood out to me that sort of certainly wasn't necessarily expecting when put it on was the 9/11 feature in it. And obviously, I think it's very important to include that, as it was very much a major world event during that era. But yeah, I wonder what your thoughts are on sort of how important that was on the musicians, sort of how it impacted them sort of creatively.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a big conversation at the start of making the film, is that like 9/11 is going to be part of this, because we're telling a very specific story about the city of New York at a certain time in history, and bang in the middle of that was the horrific events of 9/11. So we knew we couldn't shy away from it, but we knew we had to treat it sensitively, and that to be included, it had to intersect with the lives of the musicians in this. And it's kind of, you know, one of the interesting things about the story is that this scene was emerging in New York kind of before the world's eyes were about to turn on that city for a very different reason. And in Lizzie's book, we always loved the section on 9/11 because we've seen that event covered from every perspective, but we'd never seen it covered from the perspective of a sort of creative community. So, yeah, I mean, approaching it in the film, it was like it has to be there, but we want to see it in a different way, and we want to see it intersect with the stories that we're telling. So I think one of the breakthrough moments was when we got the footage of Paul from Interpol on the day of 9/11 walking the streets with, and there's like paper falling through the air from the offices, and that was just so kind of powerful, that piece of archive. Similarly, the footage of Kimya singing Anthrax, like after the event. And you know, there was this feeling amongst people of like, shit, if this can happen in our city, we should just double down and keep doing the thing that we love doing, you know, and let's react to this with creativity. And there was also like a sort of effect in that people left Manhattan, you know, the move across to Brooklyn. It was not entirely inspired by that, but you know, it certainly added to it. So yeah, it was a kind of essential part of the story that we knew we had to handle in the right way, because you don't want to like show 9/11 and the horror of that and then cut back to Julian being awkward in an interview, you know, like we wanted the sort of specter of that moment to loom over the rest of the film, as it did for everybody in the world, really.
Yeah. And also, I think a really powerful part of it is sort of through the whole film, is the way it's, we hear the voices, don't we, of the artist basically telling the story. And I think that's just such a clever trick. Rather than having a booming, overarching narrator, we get the artist narrating their own stories, which I think adds that authenticity to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of one of the first things we decided we wanted to do, which was, in the book, obviously, there are lots of other characters other than the ones we include, but it's essentially the people who were experiencing that time and that music telling their own story. And we didn't want a narrator telling us what was happening, and we didn't want to see talking head interviews where you see them now talking and looking back too much. So what was really important to us was, as much as possible, finding interviews that was happening then, so that you can, you know, hear Paul Banks in 2001, or you can hear Karen O or whoever talking as it's happening, rather than talking too much retrospectively. That was a sort of big thing for us to kind of try and keep you in the moment, try and keep you in that time.
Yeah, interesting trick that. Obviously, when you're studying all these bands, I guess you're listening to all this music again. If I asked you to pick a favourite band from that era, would it have changed from before the process to now? Did you get a new favourite?
Well, there's songs you don't want to listen to again, ever. And then, you know, it's quite interesting because we finished editing quite a while ago, and at that point, you know, you just want to have a break from it all, but it's been really nice rewatching the film as it's come out and hearing those tracks again, you know.
I was always a massive Moldy Peaches fan and a fan of that whole anti-folk scene. So, you know, actually getting to meet them, and then they reformed for the premiere in LA, wasn't it? Not New York.
In LA, yeah.
In LA, yeah. And that was just incredible, you know. But yeah, no, I love all the bands for different reasons. But as Will says, you know, once you, if you've been in Edit Suite for 2 years, there's a little, you know, there's a little bit stir craziness happens, and the songs start to relate to that experience of being in an edit, yeah, rather than, you know, the associations they had when you were young. And, you know, so yeah, we in a weird way, you sort of ruin the music for yourself for a couple of years. And it happened to me when I went to university in Liverpool, because I loved the Beatles. And then after 5 years in Liverpool, I never wanted to hear the Beatles again. but I remain a massive Beatles fan now, so I'm sure we'll go back to this music as well.
I mean, also, there were certain things, certain tracks in the film that we discovered, performances like TV on the radio when they sing Ambulance, that which is kind of, that live version is very different than the recorded version, which we sort of fell in love with. So that was a brilliant part of it, getting to hear, you know, live performances that you hadn't necessarily heard before of certain tracks, and kind of rediscovering the music that way. That was sort of a brilliant thing to be able to experience.
Yeah, and you mentioned there Mouldy Peaches reforming for the premiere. What's the feedback been like from the bands? Have you heard much from them?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's like, you know, everyone was supported the project and helped us with the archive. And then we did do some interviews towards the end of the project where we were just looking for, you know, little bits of interview to provide context where we couldn't find it in archives. So they're all very much involved throughout the process. And then, you know, Nick came and DJed the after party when we did the premiere in LA, Nick from the AAS, and everyone's been really, really positive. You know, it was such a kind of collaborative thing, and it needed to be able to get all of the footage that is in there. So yeah, we've had really good feedback.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's great to obviously from our perspective to see these bands reform in and doing their 15 and 20 anniversary shows and things. And they like the Walkman have just announced a comeback, which is, you know, really exciting. You know, but you know, we're very nostalgic of that era, but lots of these things are quite cyclical. You know, what do you think it would take for a similar era to be launched again, or do you think times are just too different now?
It's interesting because I wonder if all of those bands would argue that they weren't reforming and that they hadn't stopped.
Yeah.
you know, because I think there's a little bit of cynicism towards that kind of nostalgia circuit, isn't there? And but yeah, I mean, one of the questions we asked ourselves when we were making the film was like, could this ever happen again? Could a scene emerge in a geographically specific location, a city, you know, in as organic, you know, now we have the internet and people can market themselves on social media, and, you know, music is consumed in a very different way. We kept wondering whether this was the sort of last scene like this that would emerge in the way that it did. You know, which, and also the way that people kind of experience music now, like, people have access to everything, you know, from every period all at once. And we do seem to have a very different relationship to music. I don't know if people listen to whole albums as much as they once did. But actually, your question was about, would there be another scene that reemerges in this way? And yeah, I don't know. Like the sort of rumblings around like the whole like British scene that happened afterwards, you know, that those guys are kind of popping up everywhere now and then. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Will?
Not sure. I'm sure, yeah, you know, I'm sure in terms of like a scene, a different type of scene emerging, people are always going to want to go to be attracted to London or New York or wherever. So there's every chance of that happening. But in terms of, yeah, I don't really know if I've, you know, like if, like I think, like you said, Dylan, I don't think any of these New York bands from our film have ever gone away. They've just carried on making music. They're just right now, there appears to be a moment when they're all releasing albums at the same time, but yeah
really, it's for the next generation to sort out themselves. We'll just keep reminiscing about our good old days with Meet Me in the Bathroom, which you can see, I believe, in 48 cinemas across the UK and available to stream on Amazon Video and Apple TV and Microsoft as well. Guys, thanks so much for chatting to us today. We love the film, as we said at the top. We love that era of music. Just fantastic to see that wonderful footage and story that you've told. So, Dylan, Will, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Cheers.
Thanks a lot, guys. Amazing work. Cheers.
We did it. I still can't believe we got this project done so fast and so well.
When I'm in New York,
I'm in Chicago,
and I'm in LA, but
we're making it happen in Miro.
Together.
Our best work just happens faster on Miro's collaborative online whiteboard. No more scheduling meeting after meeting for work that could happen
from anywhere. Whether it's getting design feedback here,
mapping timelines here,
or brainstorming next steps here. It all just happens on the Miro board.
Exactly. And it's nice not having to wait an entire day to get sign-off from this guy.
Hey! Well, it is true.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com. The first three boards are free forever. That's Miro.com.